No country should have to protect itself as much as so many African nations have since the end of the Second World War. Burkina Faso is experiencing the kind of aggression a nation at war would expect to face. Captain Ibrahim Traoré has been the target of more than 21 assassination attempts. Where is all this aggression coming from? Many fingers are pointing towards the democracy-loving West, as if hypocrisy needed a new name. The endless promotion of war, hate, fear, and aggression in order to create money to facilitate wealth for elites is a failed project. In the desperation of trying to push it through, the extreme right has decided to set fire to the world. Dramatic, but unfortunately true. Their efforts have been met with resistance, finally. People no longer blindly believe their lies. We know the truth because we can see the truth. It unfolds before our eyes every day. Let us follow the torch of freedom carried by the people of Burkina Faso and Gen Z from Kenya, who rose up last year against their own government, and set our own minds free. As always, my special thanks to Eshiru. Your insight and perspective, as always, are energizing. This is Two in a Mic. Rise up and be curious.
Dung weche pek kuduelo mabiro e Two in a Mic. Dung parodit kod jok mawuoye Two in a Mic. Seche tin sud buta wawinjie Two in a Mic. Wala wachokre, wabed piny, bi wawinje. Ero chako, domomit ndi, Two in a Mic. Podcast makende.
Eshiru is back with me for another conversation. Eshiru, my brother, how's it going?
Yeah, very well, Zach. Thank you for having me back once again.
Yeah, it's always good. I tell you, it's for me, this podcast is your second home.
Absolutely.
You're always welcome on it. We had a really good plan of what to talk about, but we've put that a little bit to the side because of some of the events and some of the news coming out of Burkina Faso over the last 10 days to 2 weeks. So just in case people are not aware, there's another assassination attempt on Ibrahim Traoré. Apparently on this occasion it was quite extensive. There were former military and current military members of the Burkina Faso military, I should say, as well as people from other African nations involved, plus from all of the reports, Western influence. Now, some suggest that Western influence was France, some say the USA, some say both, some just keep it vague and say Western influence. But this is what, number 2021. What do you think about all of this, Eshiru?
Yeah, I think you're correct in saying, I cannot add anything regarding the attempt on African nations. I am aware that the Ivory Coast has been a long time asset of Western security services, but I am aware of the United States. I think his name is General Langley, who claimed that Ibrahim Traoré is using Burkina Faso's gold to protect himself personally. And I think what I find fascinating is, first of all, the claims are unfounded, okay? He provides no evidence, he just makes a claim. Secondly, if it was actually true, what the hell does it have to do with the US? The gold doesn't belong to them, it belongs to Burkina Faso. And there was some murmurs that France, Emmanuel Macron, was saying that he didn't feel that it was time to leave that region or to leave Africa because Africa still needed help in developing. So I sat and thought to myself, well, you guys have been in Africa since the late 1600s and Africa has not improved. In fact, Africa has gone backwards. What are you going to add now that's going to make them different? The world is shifting. Okay, we're moving into a multipolar world, right? Which is a better fit. America had its opportunity at the end of the Cold War, and all it done was increase the amount of wars we had on the planet, the devastation and destruction. It's failed. The Northern Hemisphere has had its opportunity to help develop the Global South, and it's done nothing. All it done is exacerbated poverty in the South, and also here at home. If you look at the way things are currently in most Western industrialized countries, food prices have gone through the roof, energy prices have gone through the roof, people's quality of lives have diminished. One thing that's remained constant is wages, so we've actually got less in our pockets than we had before. So I just see what happening in Burkina Faso is, you know, the final throes of a dying man trying to save what little he has left and what little control and power he has left. The West is dying slowly, and the future of the world lies in the Far East and the Global South, in emerging markets. That's it.
I mean, just to quickly touch on a point that you're making there, people, when we talk about what Western countries are doing in other areas, people tend to be, we talk about Europeans and North Americans and so on, they tend to defend their own country's efforts in other countries. However, when we come to then analyze what these governments are doing in their own countries, so for example, let's say a British guy who's analyzing what's happening in Burkina Faso would say, yeah, but you know, when we go to places like Burkina Faso, we put this in, we do that and so on, we manage things in a way which is better there, we fix the corruption and so on. But if the same guy analyzes what the British government is doing in the UK, they turn and say, oh man, it's absolutely terrible, the NHS is on its knees, the economy is absolutely pants, people can't... So 1 minute, where is this objectivity when we're talking about political efforts in other countries? Where is the fact, if the UK government is so good abroad, why can't it be good at home?
This is the very question. I think that people just can't remain consistent in their thoughts, okay? And we also know that there's a lot of gaslighting from the media and our governments. They will tell us that there's no money to feed the poor. There's no money to build affordable housing. There's no money to increase wages. But they'll loan money from the bank to finance weapon sales. That's literally public money that they've created out of thin air, finance officer, to go and create more death and destruction, which will then probably create more refugees that will then end up coming to your country to put even more of a strain on the system that they're underfunding. Do you understand me? What I see is this. Hannah Arendt wrote a book called Fascism, and in it she talks about the late stage capitalism. And just before we head into the fascism part, late stage capitalism is where the wealthy shore up as much as the wealth as they possibly can. They pass more and more draconian laws to keep the citizens in place and stop them uprising. Prices rise, citizens get by on less. This is the situation that we're living in. It's happened before on several occasions, and this is where we are today. And all I see is, because I believe that the West knows they're on a losing streak, they're going to have to hand over the reins at some point. They're trying their best to hang on to what they possibly can. That's it right about now.
Yeah. I remember once reading an interview in the post-Cotonou era, and a lot of African nations were sitting down with European representatives to talk about a new deal, to talk about a way forward. And the commentary at the time was basically European leaders still looking down their noses at African nations' representatives. They still found themselves to be superior. And a lot of the commentary was basically saying, well, if that's the way you're going to look at us, why on earth should African nations continue to do business with you?
Well, if you look at yesterday, Tony Blair was, I think he was quoted as saying something about hitting the climate targets going to fail, or that they shouldn't even bother trying to hit the targets because they're going to fail. And then today I read that banks have loaned £75 billion to industries that they know are damaging the climate. And I've said this. A lot of the problems that we have on this planet is facilitated mostly by the West, whether that's through war, whether that's through fossil fuel or climate or environmental damaging industries, the over deforestation of crucial rainforests around the globe, just to feed this capitalist system. And I've said that in order to fight a lot of the challenges that we have facing humanity, they need to bring those to the table that are most likely to be affected by climate and environmental disaster. And that are those right now who are the voiceless. These are the people in the global South, South Americans, the people in the Caribbean, and the people in Africa and the Middle East. These are the people who are not being brought to the table, yet we're all to share the blame for what's going on with the planet. When you look at who is actually to blame, it's the industrialized countries of the North that are exploiting through a system the natural resources that we have on offer.
Yep. And then when obviously nations which have their own natural resources decide that they want to be able to manage them themselves, they don't want to have foreign companies doing the job for them, then they get labeled, as you said. General Langley has turned around and said that they're using their own resources for their own protection, which in itself is a bit weird. I seem to remember the one occasion when Obama came to Berlin, and I think the cost of security for Obama's trip was picked up by the German taxpayer, and it ran into the millions. Nobody said anything then about a country spending so much money on protection. So now they're commenting on Burkina Faso as to why they would use protection as the particular, let's say, vehicle of criticism, has only perhaps become clearer recently when we found out that allegedly Traore has made an agreement with Russia to supply protection, but on top of that also to supply weapons and training to Burkina Faso's military.
Exactly, my friend. I think that we're in a position where the US doesn't like the idea that its enemy, I say that in air quotes, has one up on them. I'm not sure if you noticed today, Donald Trump has apparently signed an agreement with Ukraine for God knows how many billions for the rare earth minerals. This is what we know much of the war was about. Despite all the background noise, this is what it was always about, okay? America feels like they've won. And now Putin's right, probably stepped back and thought, well, I've got an opportunity here to go into Burkina Faso, offer them security. There is a deal for gold on the table that I'm aware of. And of course, America doesn't like that because they don't believe that anybody should get anything apart from them. That's it. But for me, I'm glad if Putin's down there, as long as if he's providing security and as long as he's not, and of course he's there for himself, let's make no bones about that. But if he's not hindering the progress of the country, then why shouldn't he be there giving them protection? Let's remember Mali, Niger, and Zambia had that project called the Lupino Project, where they wanted to extract, process cobalt, and then manufacture batteries. So one country would extract, one country would process, and they would move to another country to manufacture batteries for electric vehicles. And Joe Biden says, no, they couldn't do it without America being involved, literally putting a stop to it straight away. So here are African nations. They have all the minerals. They don't need anybody. Let's remember that. Africa doesn't need the world. The world needs Africa. Africa can be self-sufficient, right? So here are three African countries. They decided, well, let's do something to service the international market. And America steps in and tells them, no. That's like me coming to your house, Zach, and telling your wife and your son that they can't eat dinner and they can't watch TV. And you, Zach, you can't take a shower. You know, that's how it is, essentially. You know, you can't take a shower. That's essentially it, right? How ludicrous would that be? But yet we allow them to get away with it time after time. And this is why I'm happy that people are supporting Captain Ibrahim Traore. I'm so pleased that he's had so much support from the diaspora globally, as well as on the continent.
Yeah. In fact, I mean, there have been quite a few opportunities for people to express themselves that I have seen on social media. I've also made a couple of TikTok videos, and the response has been, thanks, well done for speaking out. And a lot of people are actually rooting for Burkina Faso. Now, also, just to point out, we are not, or at least let me speak, I am not in any way pro-Putin or pro-Russia. What I am, however, is pro-Burkina Faso and also pro-Burkina Faso's right to make its own decisions.
Absolutely. I'm 100% in agreement with you. I'm not pro-Putin either. I just want to let people know. I don't believe his stance on LGBTQ, for example, in his country. And there are a lot of things about the way that he runs his country is wrong. Same as how we've said about our leaders here. There are many things that they do wrong in this country. But I am for Burkina Faso and the African continent and countries within Africa to determine their own right. They should be able to decide. They're already locked out of all the key decisions that happen in the world. When do you see African nations invited to the G20? They're just not there. You may see South Africa thrown in there, and maybe they'll throw India in the mix. But there are no African countries, but yet decisions are taken for them on a daily basis. As you said this earlier, as people they're looked down upon. Shahid Bolson, who's a very good analyst in the world, he said recently, if you look at Africa, the West still looks upon it as it did in the 16 and the 17 and the 1800s. It doesn't view it any differently. That's the mindset of certainly the leaders and so on, that they view it still in the 16 and the 17 and the 1800s, that it hasn't developed in any way, which is incorrect.
Now, actually, I think you're right when you said many people as well. There has recently been, at least because I also attended, I think I sent you photographs as well. I attended a photography exhibition here in Berlin. And one of the main points behind the exhibition was to show photographs, to show images of the last 200 or 300 years of African nations, including during the times of colonialism, but to give the African perspective, because we still think, whenever we think about African nations going back to colonial times, we still only think in terms of victims, in terms of impoverished, in terms of slaves, in terms of people who are incapable of defending themselves.
All right.
And you've made the point many times, nobody ever talks about the continuous uprisings, the continuous rebellions against the slave trade, against colonial powers. Nobody ever mentioned those. And so it's very important that we actually think, do you know what? The West has been conditioned over the last 200, 300, 400 years to think about African nations in this way, and we have to change that.
100% agree. And this is one of the things that I've often spoken with people on social media about. Certainly when I've managed to get into a heated discussion with some, and they still seem to think that Africans live in mud huts and throw spears. Of course, some parts of Africa have their culture. You won't get away from that. But if you look at Africa as a whole, it's developed in many, many, many ways. I mean, if you walk in some of these major cities across Africa, you wouldn't believe you're in Africa. You'd believe you're in any industrialized nation in the world, but you never see that side of Africa because Africans are supposed to be stupid. But let's remember, there has been an industrial effort to separate Africa and Africans from their history. The West, as we know, spent the last 300 or 400 years letting Africans know that you're stupid and you never come from anything. And Egypt is a great one for me. I think we might have even touched on this in the last episode, but we'll bring it up again, that the Egyptians today can trace their lineage back through the Greeks and the Turks and the Arabs. But the Egyptians that built the pyramids, the Egyptians that were there before, were the black people from sub-Saharan Africa, the Nubians and the Kushites. They were in Egypt. They were the pharaohs. They were the ones that built the pyramids. But of course, the West, because it spent centuries destroying Africa so that there'd be no trace of who we were, they've spent hundreds of years persuading North Africans that they're more akin to Europeans because they've got light skin. and they've redrawn the map of Africa, calling North Africa now the Middle East, you know. And if you look at the people that were in North Africa that were pro-sub-Saharan Africa, Anwar Sadat, Colonel Gaddafi, let's remember, let me get this right, Abel Nassar took in Patrice Lumumba's children, yes, and raised them. This is a fact. And that just goes to show you about how they had unity in Africa, North and Sub-Saharan, and the West, of course, fractured that unity and told the people in the North that they were better than the people in the South, redrew the map to claim that as the Middle East, got rid of Gaddafi, put their puppets in Tunisia, in Egypt, and Libya is now a failed state. All the doing of the West, all of the West hands.
Let's also not forget that the 1960s was also around the time when, you know better than I do, Malcolm X, the first time he said that he felt that a white-skinned person, more or less, actually thought in a positive way towards what he would say the black man, was when he went on his pilgrimage and he went through Egypt. And obviously he was assassinated in 1965. So therefore, as in when you are talking about the powers in place which try to create as much division as they could behind the lighter-toned countries in the North and the rest of the African continent, people can look at these kinds of events.
Of course they have to, because all of it, they're all tied, they're all linked, all of them. When I look at the assassination of Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, Fred Hampton, JFK, Patrice Lumumba, and the first general secretary of the UN, a guy called Dag Hammarskjöld, Swedish, all of them are connected, they're all linked, all of them. You can put the markers in, Anwar Sadat, Abel Nassar, you can put the markers in and you can see that they're all connected. These people would have unified, they would have done something special for Africa. And of course, I have to get, because they are, I'm going to be bold and say, we have a socially engineered natural order of things, okay? If Africa was to become unified and Africa was to decide its own fate from the rest of the world, what do you think that would do to the balance, the shift of the world? Where do you think that socially engineered natural order of things would be? It would literally flip it like this, because the global North then will have nothing. It will no longer be a powerhouse, because Africa would then assume that role. And who are they going to most likely work with? The people that once enslaved them, or the people who are trying to save them?
Yeah.
And that would literally flip the balance of power. And they have a vested interest to stop that from happening. That's just my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of evidence which would back that up. A lot of these assassinations that were carried out later on, 30, 40, 50 years later, people came forward. For example, I think there was a Belgian that came forward and said that, we were involved in the assassination of Patrice Lumumba. Right. These are facts which cannot in any way be denied. That's just the way it is.
And that's what makes, you know, coming back to Traoré, that's what makes it so important that we talk about him and we do what we can, because we've lost so many great revolutionary leaders. So many leaders that have been visionary, so many leaders that wanted. Just think if Africa was allowed to develop from the days of Patrice Lumumba, could you imagine the world? It would be better for the world to have that. It would be far better. The world would be in a much healthier place today if the Middle East was left alone to develop, and if Africa was left alone to develop. It would be. That's it. It would be. There is no doubt in that. I'm not saying we wouldn't have problems. But my point is that we wouldn't have, what is the count, about 120 million people who are displaced currently, globally?
Yeah, I think the figure is something like as high as you say there. I don't have the figures in front of me at the moment. But another name that I'd like to throw into this, and we want to talk about him as well, obviously, is Marcus Garvey. And and he is indeed a character who had a particular desire and wish to pursue his idea of Pan-Africanism, and wherever possible he was either prevented from doing so, or he was hindered in some way, or there was some kind of a sabotage underway with regards to making things difficult for him. So for a very long time, a lot of different countries, a lot of different powers have been involved in trying to stop African nations from achieving what they wanted to do so themselves. Even I read a book about Nigeria, about a chance missed. And even there, they mention how the Metropolitan Police in the 1990s had arrested a Nigerian politician just so that he was not able to participate in elections.
That's correct. That's correct. That's correct. I even believe that. Didn't they stop Nelson Mandela's son also entering a particular country when he was on his way to show support?
I believe so. Yeah.
Yeah, this was just last year, I believe, or the year before.
Very course, recent, yeah.
This is what they do constantly. Marcus Mosiah Garvey, Jamaican-born, he was the creator of the Pan-African flag, as I said. Some people call him the godfather of Pan-Africanism, but he believed in the repatriation of Black people back to Africa. This is one of the things that he advocated, because he was saying that we should build our own. That's what he advocated. And he's, to date, he's the only Black person to have ever had a shipping company, and he had his own shipping company called Black Star Liners. The hope was to be able to use the shipping company to move people and their goods back to Africa. I believe that at the height of his, I think it was the United Negro Improvement Association, the UNIA, I believe at the height of it, its membership, it had something like 20 or 30 million people worldwide. This was back in the 20s or 30s, long before we even had any internet, and he was able to mobilize that many people globally. Of course he's going to be a threat. Same with Malcolm X, same with Martin Luther King, same with Fred Hampton. Only 21 when they got rid of him, you know. Now look at the state of the world today and tell me things are better. Tell me. They aren't.
No, you know, not.
Things are not absolutely better. Not. Things are a lot worse. But I believe, I have this theory that when we left, I'm not talking about ancient history when they took us out of Africa, but certainly from the Caribbean. Many people left the Caribbean, the diaspora, and they went to Canada and Britain and the US. And I believe that we all came here with this promise of, you know, streets are paved with gold and people are able to make loads of money. And many people moved here, streets weren't paved with gold. They lived in substandard accommodation. Some of them left their families. Some never saw their families again because they came here and they were felt ashamed. Some people even started new families, leaving kids abroad, and they sent for them later. There's a whole new episode or series of podcasts we can discuss around this. But the theory that I have is they brought us here and kept us here so we can service the needs of the wealthy, those descendants of those that once owned our ancestors. So, and then the countries that we left, these are the countries that they now live, buying up the land cheap, building beautiful homes, living nicely off our labor here. So this is slavery 2.0. But it isn't just us, it's people from all over the world. Do you understand me?
That's a
theory I have. So so we're out here servicing men while they're there enjoying themselves in beautiful places all around the globe.
Yeah.
Interesting.
It is interesting. And the unfortunate thing is that so much of this is, as you said before, connected. And it's also connected to why you have poor majority white communities in some areas of the north of England. That's also connected, you know. And this is also why you and I have often said that the problem for those poor majority white communities in the north of England are not the people arriving by boat, are not the people who are fleeing war-torn areas. The reason for that poverty in those communities in the north of England is essentially the corrupt elites, political elites.
Well, they don't care about them. There's a documentary that came out on Channel 4, I think last night or the night before, called Groomed, a National Scandal. And they were talking about white girls being groomed by Pakistani men. So in this country, they're focusing on men that commit 3% of grooming cases. 3%, okay? They're focusing on that. Instead of focusing on grooming as a whole, as a big problem, they're focusing on the men that commit 3% of the crime. Now, the only time they ever talk about white working class is when they want to use white working class against black and brown working class. It's the only time they talk about them. Other than that, they don't care about them. Nobody ever asks why white working class people poor. We already know why black people are treated the way they do, and Muslims, it's because we're Muslim and black, right? That's it. They don't like that. I'm just being honest. I'm not, you know, it's the state of play. But the only time they ever talk about white working class is when they pit them against us. And the question I always have is, why don't they compare the white working class against white middle class? That's where the real measure should be. That's where the real comparison should be. And yesterday, when they're talking about grooming, this is the reason that they always give. The authorities have been saying this for about 10 years. The reason why they never investigated why white working class girls were being groomed by Pakistani men is because they didn't want to come across as racist. And they use this line again yesterday. Now, everybody who's black and brown will shake their head and say, these damn people and their lies. The reason why they didn't investigate is because they don't care about these girls, because they're poor and working class. These are the people that they actually look down upon, okay? But the authorities fail to take care of the girls, so they use the, oh, we don't want to come across as racist. But when you look deeply into some of these authorities and the police that are involved, a lot of them are actually being charged with cases of racism. They've got so many cases of racism pending against them anyway. They don't care about racism. It's because they fail to help the girls, because they just thought, ah, nobody cares about them. They're only, you know, a derogatory word. You understand me? Yeah. And that's just how it is. But then always, and I try to get so many people to understand, well, certainly white working class people to look. And that, I mean, even that word white working class is such so loaded. White working class people are more likely to live next door to you and I in places.
Absolutely.
If I run out of sugar in the middle of the night and I need sugar or some milk, I can knock my white working class neighbor's door and borrow some sugar and milk. They can come to mine and do the same. Mm. You know, if I'm that close to them and say, John, whatever, can I borrow five? I'm broke. They can come to me because we've known each other for 20 years. There's nobody in the upper classes I can do that to.
No.
Yet they use the white working class people as this.
They've been whipped up into a frenzy because
basically, yeah.
And they've been told, okay, point your finger in that direction, guys.
And it incenses me.
Yeah.
It incenses me. It really does, because as I said, I have more in common with them. They have more in common with me than these people from the upper echelons of society that don't care about either of us.
Yeah.
You know, a lot to talk about, a lot to unpack.
Yeah. But the interesting thing, as you say, there's so much that we could talk about in all of these interconnected topics. And but we do, I would really like to come back before we conclude to talking about Burkina Faso, because I find Traoré, Captain Traoré, to be an inspiration in many ways. I know he came about as leader as part of a coup. I know he's not a democratically elected president. However, he does have the support of very large numbers of people within the country. They can see what he's doing. His government also, in the last few weeks, announced free education up to university in Burkina Faso. So, is it just as an example of the kind of person that he is? Now, my concern is the following: as he has now commissioned, or he has now purchased, the service of Russian special security for him, for other members of his government, also to train up the military and so on. Do you see the chances of Burkina Faso being thrown into another proxy war between the West and Russia?
If you look at the US, the only thing that they've developed is AFRICOM, which is the military units. That's the only thing they've developed in Africa, because the US is a war economy, okay? It's dependent on war to thrive. I can definitely see them doing something to try and destabilize the country. I mean, let's remember, right, what's happening in the Congo is the M23 are being backed by the US, who are also backing Paul Kagame, who are also working to destabilize, to keep Congo destabilized as it is. So, you know, the West can access the minerals the way it is now. So from what I know, Ivory Coast is one of these countries that have always been it's been as an agent, if you will, for destabilization in that part of Africa, for the West. And I believe that Langley was in Ivory Coast, that's General Langley, the US military top brass. I believe he was in the Ivory Coast. And although I'm not sure what the details of his trip was, I can be more or less certain that he's trying to try something, of course, because America doesn't like losing. It doesn't like losing to Russia. But at the same time, they believe the gold belongs to them and nobody else. And that's how it should be. And black people should remain poor and die. And that's how America thinks.
But it's also worrying in the way that lots of little negative news tidbits are starting to come into play with regards to Burkina Faso. And today I read as well that the USA has listed Burkina Faso as level 4, I believe, of a country not to visit because of the dangerous situation that there is
there. Which is all lies. It's all it is. It's just an attempt to character assassinate him and the country. That's all it is. Nothing else. Okay. It's all part of an information war to make people view it as a bad place. That's it. This is how they work. This is how they operate. It always is. And again, it is about. But let's also remember, the US wants to control a lot of the rare earth minerals as possible because the Chinese, I believe, own. They control something like 80% of the world's rare earth minerals, and the US doesn't feel like it wants to lose out to that because I think most of the semiconductor chip production happens in the Far East, right? Korea is one of these countries, and I believe China, Taiwan might even be in the mix there. It's just the US up to its old tricks. That's basically what it is. That's what's going on.
Mm. Yeah. So, I mean, what I would implore anybody to do is don't jump to any kinds of conclusions with regards to what's going on in Burkina Faso. Please be extremely curious. Go out, find out for yourselves. I'm not saying get on a plane and fly out there. I mean, if you want to, of course, and why not? I'm sure it's a fantastic experience. But there are also easier ways to come via information. Don't go via the mainstream media, which is if that's your only source. I think the mainstream media is a good place to use as a comparison to other news sources, but be careful. The news sources that you look at, there are lots and lots of Western news sources which say that call themselves African this or African that, but go and look at the website and see where their head offices are, see where the funding organizations are, and try to find sources from within the continent of Africa, because they're more likely to give you a realistic take.
100% correct. 100% correct. I think that people need to be a little bit more. There's a new app that I found called African Diaspora News, as well as Al Jazeera. We know it's a very good balance, gives a balanced view. People need to go and search the content for themselves. Don't follow the Western media. The Western media it no longer informs. You're right in saying use it as a tool to do comparisons, but not use it as a rule, because it no longer informs. It creates narrative, shapes opinions.
And people have to realize that a lot of the mainstream media is owned by certain kinds of individuals. We know that, you know, Rupert Murdoch owns huge news outlets. Jeff Bezos also owns, I think, is it Washington Post or Washington?
Correct.
Yeah. So
as in a few smaller ones. Yeah.
So as in these are individuals, obviously, who have vested interests, either economic or political. So we have to be aware of these things.
Correct.
We're hoping then that peace will remain in Burkina Faso. We hope that a long period of peace actually in the entire area will eventually arrive, and we can then see the benefits of peace. I mean, I'm not sure when the last time was that the continent of Africa did not have some kind of war or tragic situation there forced upon it.
Well, there's a saying that if you want peace, you have to be prepared for war.
It's an unfortunate problem, isn't it?
Of course. But I think that when we look at, as I said, you know, America, the US rather, I shouldn't say America, I must keep remembering that the United States of America is a war economy. It is dependent on war to function. So it will always try and stoke flames in places. That's just how it is.
Eshri, what can I say? Thank you very much. Always passionate discourse. I really appreciate the insight and the analysis. I look forward to the next time when we will get to talk about what we had planned to talk about this time.
Yes, indeed. Thank you for having me, brother.
Two and a mic.